Welcome back, listeners. My name is Jackson Vickery, and I am the host and producer of the JV Club podcast. On this episode, I spoke to the composer of The Holdovers, Mark Orton. He rejoins Alexander Payne after scoring the Academy Award-nominated film Nebraska. The Holdovers stars Paul Giamatti, Divine Joy Randolph, and Dominique Sessa.
Just to dive into the interview, I mean, I'm curious as to where you first met Alexander Payne. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so it really came about through his longtime music editor, who's a guy that I do a lot of work with. I've worked on a bunch of projects with, but Richard Ford is his name, and his relationship with Alexander goes back to Election. He's done all the films with him since then. And you know what, a music editor is a person, there are several jobs they have throughout the pre and post-production process, but basically they're in there temping music, building a temporary score of music, some of which will sometimes stick from the early edits of the film, like in the early stages, helping to establish the musical tone and the kind of the shape, how it matches up with the narrative, all of that. And so they're often just grabbing music from other films or from artists outside of film scoring, you know, just from musicians. And so with Nebraska, Richard had temped in a lot of my music. I mean, there was a point sort of late in the game where I think it was something, there were 25 music cues in the film, original music cues, and like 23 were mine. And two were like from my bandmate, Rob Berger, who was in Tin Hat Trio with me. So it was kind of very much my score in there. And there's a thing in the industry we refer to as temp love, which for an original music composer can be very difficult to deal with if a director has really fallen in love with a cue and it's lived in the film in various stages of the edit as it's progressing over months. It can be very hard to beat that piece of music. It becomes kind of ingrained in the film. And so I benefited in this case from temp love. that was how I met him, is that he got in touch with me to say, you know, I've been using your music in the film and I really love it. And he knew I was a composer. We had some other connections as well through the industry, through the producers that were working on it, that used to come see my band, like play at Largo or, you know, different places or whatever. So there were these connections, and we ended up meeting up for a minute, and I sort of helped dress the film for Cannes for its premiere. And I decided to go there as well, but that was still honestly operating under the assumption that the film score would eventually be replaced by his longtime collaborator, Ralph Kent. But after meeting him and the work that I did and kind of prepping it for Cannes, then it just at that point didn't make sense to use someone but me, and Alexander and I had a good rapport and had kind of established something. So then I went back in and actually scored a bunch of the film. I mean, that's why, though, on the converse or sort of maybe downside of that was, because there was a bunch of pre-existing music in the end, it didn't qualify for Oscars. I think there was a shot otherwise. The film got, I think, 6 nominations, and that score had been chosen in the top, you know, 5 by most folks. And anyway, but whatever. Good problem to have in the end.
Yeah. And so where do you first hear about The Holdovers?
So I was contacted pretty early on, like long before I'm seeing any footage or anything like that. So Alexander got in touch. I think they had temped in a little bit of my music early on, still kind of were trying to figure out They knew certain things about the musical direction from the get-go, because so much of this is about it being not even a period film in the classic sense. It's not a movie about, you know, whatever, 1970. It's actually a movie that feels like it was made in 1970. So yeah, like across the board, technically. And so I think there was a certain amount that just had to do with not betraying the sound or the feel of that sort of, that it had this kind of like early 70s production value. Anyway, he got in touch with me, and we met up here in Portland where I live. So he loves Portland and came up for that. There are other actual members of the team who live here as well. Production designer, for instance. But anyway, we spent a week together just working on music, like without picture, even without the script, just based on the story and based on the time period, and kind of feeling out what aspects of early 70s sounds he was and wasn't drawn to. So this is not some like early 70s funk score or some like post psychedelic score or something. There's a lot of different music going on in 1970. But I started writing, and actually wrote like the same way that you might write a kind of overture or a suite of orchestral pieces for a different kind of thing based maybe on the script or on the story, even before you're going in and working with picture. I wrote like a set of songs that were based around things he was drawn to. And we worked together for that week, and then I used a bunch of that music and as like, you know, and seeded it into the film, used it as like starting places for other cues, and then started working with picture after that. But that was, you know, a month before I was getting anything with, you know, on my computer with actual picture to work with. So
Yeah, I actually have spoken to the production designer, and I feel like you guys have somewhat similar stories in the way that, the way that Alexander works to sort of get involved very early on in the process and just sort of start to build out those fine details even before it really starts taking its shape in whatever sort of timeline that needs to fit. So I think that's so cool.
I think it comes with, it's married to his aesthetic though too, because he's like this familial guy with his people. I mean, it's the same folks working on all these projects. And Ryan and I are relative newcomers to it. I mean, in Nebraska, but there's many folks on his team that have been there all through. And it's having just come back from seeing Toronto, the film in Toronto at TIFF and down at the LA at the Academy Museum. It's a real like sort of great little community that he's built around his filmmaking. So
absolutely. And I do want to just dive into one of the pieces in particular, and that would be Into the Unknown. And I'm taking there's just such a strong holding with me and that song or that piece. And I'm just wondering if you could just sort of break down, there's so many other fabulous to break into, but I'm curious for that one, how you sort of tapped into that, how it was sort of its first gestation, and then how it ended up where it was placed in the film and just how it sort of took its shape.
Yeah, so it has an interesting story. There was a funny coincidence with this film. I mean, there are two ways in which getting into the music of this film bring a kind of like instant nostalgia connection, personal, emotional nostalgia kind of connection for me. One is that I grew up, you know, I was born in 1968. And so in 1970, I was only 2 years old, but I had a brother 10 years older, a sister 10 years older, more or less. And I, growing up, as much as I've had this father who's a conductor and a big presence in my life musically, I absolutely coveted my brother's record collection. And so those sounds, like that early 70s and 70s generally sound, I mean, that's what I grew up with, and that's the stuff I was covering in bands. So getting at this, some of the stuff we're getting at in that regard, it's not so much putting on a hat as like revisiting my childhood and my early bands. And so that was really great for me. But to your question with Into the Unknown, which was actually written first for the montage drive to Boston. So when I'm not, don't want to give too much away, but I suppose the title does. But anyway, drive to Boston, that was the first iteration of that theme. So Alexander didn't know this, but I lived just about a mile and a half from where this film was shot. It's up near Amherst in Western Massachusetts. I've lived there three times. I've flirted with moving there permanently twice, and in the end settled on Portland, but it's a part of the world that I greatly miss. And it's a place where I used to drive around on those roads. I really love that part of New England. I love that part of Massachusetts. I used to drive around on those same roads, and there was just something about that area that resonated with me, especially in winter. It's one thing I miss in Portland. We don't get those kinds of winters here, or they're just hit or miss kind of. And so then getting to score like a montage scene of them driving around those same country roads that I recognized, it just had a kind of deep resonance for me. I also think that that cue in particular ties a bit more to the sound, the world of Nebraska, that kind of their traveling music. In fact, at some point, I think we were kiddingly calling that one Nebraska-esque. it's its own thing because it's not so Americana-based. In its instrumentation, there's like electric piano and you know, bass and some percussion and stuff that wasn't in the Nebraska score, but there is something of that there. So yeah, it's I do a lot of my writing, actually, like I do most of my writing in my head, and that's the kind of tune that you're hearing there for Into the Unknown, Drive to Boston, same melody that I would be writing literally by, like, you know, singing into my little handheld tape recorder, or even just sort of memorizing in my brain. That's that kind of melody. And it would be something I'd probably write while traveling myself. So.
I love that. And maybe that's why it sticks with me so much, because it is, as you said, Nebraska-esque, because I don't know that, like I said, that film means so much to me. So, I also think
it's like a song without words, which there's several of on this film, but you know, there's different kinds of scoring. There's stuff that's more ambient, there's stuff that's more kind of like orchestral and long form, but that piece you're talking about is really kind of a song without words, you know. That's what it feels like to me anyway.
Absolutely. And I mean, I love the use of choral in this piece in the score as well. I don't know. You don't hear that as much. Maybe it's the Amherst, Massachusetts sort of, I don't know, but.
Well, that's another easy tie to nostalgia, because my dad was a conductor, but mostly a choral conductor. And I grew up in singing in choirs and whatever. And the kind of like old, you know, somewhat stodgy East Coast prep school thing, I associate that kind of boys choir thing with it. And of course there's choral stuff in the film otherwise, with some of the source music, like the Von Trapp stuff, and there's even some British boys choir stuff in there that's covering the kind of more holiday stuff. So bringing in the boys choir with one of my themes, for the helicopter scene, won't give away more than that, that felt like a good kind of tie-in to also to the other side, the song side or source side of the score. So,
And I'd love to talk about just a couple of the characters, and just sort of where your brain went with them, sort of in maybe teasing out some of the score for them, creating pieces around them. And I mean, first to just start out with would be Paul's character. And I'm just curious where, I mean, obviously you get that sort of in the drive to Boston, and that sort of carries on, but I'm just curious, where else did you sort of start to pick up pieces for him along the way?
Yeah, It's funny. Paul, I think, has this kind of slowest reveal of the three main characters in terms of the music. I didn't do with this one, like in the trades, we call it like Peter and the Wolf. Like I didn't attach a specific theme to each character and then kind of develop and those themes or have them interplay or have some interplay with them or something. I didn't go that route with it. I've got a kind of main piano theme in there that's probably first associated with Mary, one of the other one of the three main characters, but then it evolves over time to also be Paul's theme. And it's a theme that can reflect both kind of like there's some emotion in it, maybe a little bit of drama, but it also has other dimensions to it. So it kind of allows for these multifaceted characters. I'm not trying to, you know, sound immodest about my compositions, but I think it there's a certain openness to the style and to the melodic side that's not on the nose with this is an emotional cue or this is drama and or this is comedy. And I actually think that's really important generally in working with Alexander, because he never wants the compositions or the music, the score to give anything away. He really wants it. He doesn't want to lead the audience with the music. He wants the music to, he wants the story, the acting, the narrative to be as much in charge of that. And so it is always kind of walking that line too, with his kind of that comedy drama line. So yeah, I think that in terms of like treating a character, I'd say I'm first treating the story. And then in doing that, that first piano theme, I think, attaches to Paul over the course of it. There's a point when he's got some doing some stuff with a car, putting some stuff in a car, and some of the students are outdoors towards the end. And, you know, that at that point is completely his theme, whereas it started off with Mary. I think that's sort of more broadly, I mean, there's a character arc for all three of them. And so I also want the music to reflect that, or again, using that same word, not betray it, you know, have it be kind of open or neutral enough that it allows for their, for that character development. So that's probably more what I'm thinking about. With Angus, the third character, I do use what for me was a novel scoring technique. I'm using solo alto or bass flute. And what I'm doing that is kind of, that has to do more with the kind of like loneliness, or has some built-in melancholy, that sound, that unaccompanied flute sound. I use it with the Mormon kid, who loses his glove as well. And then a couple other spots. That's a tie-in that's a little more, though, with a particular character.
I love that. No, and you hit on all three of the characters I was going to ask about, so that's perfect. And I mean, just in our final few minutes, I mean, what do you take away from working on this project? And then, I mean, finally, I mean, what do you hope that audiences take away from a project like this, and especially around the times that we're in, and around the, I mean, just the holidays in general, and just that scene, I guess you could say.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I guess like I'm, you know, I was first a fan of his filmmaking. I think the biggest takeaway for me is how few films like this are getting made these days. Mm. These kind of like human-centered dramas with just fully realized, plenty of flaws characters, you know, and how it's just, there's this kind of writing and filmmaking. It's something, it just is not, it's not the flavor of the week or month or years for Hollywood anymore. It's just not happening very often. So I think it's kind of, you know, it's nostalgic on that level, even before it's nostalgic, because it does have some holiday overtones. It is sort of at its root in some ways a Christmas movie, which is sort of the last thing in some ways I would imagine Alexander ever wanting to make. But it does kind of play that way, and it plays it from such a different sort of more human and real angle than most of the, you know, slightly fantastical ones going back through years and years of cinema. So I think, you know, it's its own version of that genre in some ways, and it's its own thing separate from whether the holidays are involved or not. But it's, yeah, what I want them to take away, I hope that for, you know, for audiences, like for me, it's this kind of great step back to a different era of filmmaking that has been kind of subsumed by all the redos and rewrites and superheroes and their origin stories and prequels and all of that. You know, this is a different thing. And I think it's fantastic that he's, you know, that he's able to do this and stick with it.
Yeah. And I guess that's what makes Alexander Payne, Alexander Payne. Just being able to sort of break the mold with sort of all of the films that he's creating. And I think that's exciting and honestly very refreshing, which is probably why I want to go back to this film so many times.
Thank you for tuning into this episode. This podcast was hosted and produced by yours truly, Jackson Vickery. But a very special thank you to Sterling Gavinsky for the theme music and to Carly Haney for the artwork. We will see you next time.